Chapter 42. Stop. Hear what I've got to say. You don't want to be an apprentice. I know, you want to make more haste, and you don't want to stand behind a counter. But if you're a copying clerk, you'll have to stand behind a desk, and stare at your ink and paper all day. There isn't much outlook there, and you won't be much wiser at the end of the year than at the beginning. The world isn't made of pen, ink, and paper, and if you're to get on in the world, young man, you must know what the world's made of. Now the best chance for you would be to have a place on a wharf, or in a warehouse, where you'd learn the smell of things, but you wouldn't like that, I'll be bound. You'd have to stand cold and wet, and be shouldered about by rough fellows. You're too fine a gentleman for that. Mr. Dean paused and looked hard at Tom, who certainly felt some inward struggle, before he could reply. I would rather do what will be best for me in the end, sir. I would put up with what was disagreeable. That's well, if you can carry it out. But you must remember it isn't only laying hold of a rope, you must go on pulling. It's the mistake you lads make that have got nothing either in your brains or your pocket, to think you've got a better start in the world, if you stick yourselves in a place, where you can keep your coats clean, and have the shop wenches take you for fine gentlemen. That wasn't the way I started, young man. When I was 16, my jacket smelt of tar, and I wasn't afraid of handling cheeses. That's the reason I can wear good broadcloth now, and have my legs under the same table with the head of the best firms in St. Ogg's. Uncle Dean tapped his box, and seemed to expand a little under his waistcoat and gold chain, as he squared his shoulders in the chair. Is there any place at liberty, that you know of now, Uncle, that I should do for? I should like to set to work at once, said Tom, with a slight tremor in his voice. Stop a bit, we mustn't be in too great a hurry. You must bear in mind, if I put you in a place you're a bit young for, because you happen to be my nephew, I shall be responsible for you. And there's no better reason, you know, than your being my nephew, because it remains to be seen whether you're good for anything. I hope I shall never do you any discredit, Uncle, said Tom, hurt, as all boys are at the statement of the unpleasant truth, that people feel no ground for trusting them. I care about my own credit too much for that. Well done, Tom, well done. That's the right spirit, and I never refuse to help anybody, if they've a mind to do themselves justice. There's a young man of 22 I've got my eye on now. I shall do what I can for that young man. He's got some pith in him. But then, you see, he's made good use of his time, a first-rate calculator, can tell you the cubic contents of anything in no time, and put me up the other day to a new market for Swedish bark. He's uncommonly knowing in manufactures, that young fellow. I'd better set about learning bookkeeping, hadn't I, Uncle? Said Tom, anxious to prove his readiness to exert himself. Yes, you can't do amiss there. But Spence, you're back again. Well, Tom, there's nothing more to be said just now, I think, and I must go to business again. Goodbye. Remember me to your mother. Mr. Dean put out his hand, with an air of friendly dismissal, and Tom had not courage to ask another question, especially in the presence of Mr. Spence. So he went out again into the cold damp air. He had to call at his Uncle Glegg's about the money in the savings bank, and by the time he set out again the mist had thickened, and he could not see very far before him. But going along River Street again, he was startled, when he was within 2 yards of the projecting side of a shop window, by the words Orlcott Mill in large letters on the handbill, placed as if on purpose to stare at him. It was the catalogue of the sale, to take place the next week. It was a reason for hurrying faster out of the town. Poor Tom formed no visions of the distant future as he made his way homeward. He only felt that the present was very hard. It seemed wrong toward him that his Uncle Dean had no confidence in him, did not see at once that he should acquit himself well, which Tom himself was as certain of the daylight. Apparently he, Tom, Tom Tulliver was likely to be held of small account in the world, and for the first time he felt a sinking of heart under the sense that he really was very ignorant and could do very little. Who was that enviable young man that could tell the cubic contents of things in no time and make suggestions about Swedish bark? Tom had been used to be so entirely satisfied with himself, in spite of his breaking down in a demonstration, and construing Nungilla's bromide fires as I'll promise those men. But now he suddenly felt at a disadvantage, because he knew less than someone else knew. There must be a world of things connected with that Swedish bark, which, if he only knew them, might have helped him to get on. It would have been much easier to make a figure with a spirited horse and a new saddle. 2 hours ago, as Tom was walking to St. Ogg's, he saw the distant future before him as he might have seen a tempting stretch of smooth sandy beach beyond a belt of flinty shingles. He was on the grassy bank then, and thought the shingles might soon be passed. But now his feet were on the sharp stones. The belt of shingles had widened, and the stretch of sand had dwindled into narrowness. "What did my Uncle Dean say, Tom?" said Maggie, putting her arm through Tom's as he was warming himself rather drearily by the kitchen fire. "Did he say he would give you a situation?" "No, he didn't say that. He didn't quite promise me anything. He seemed to think I couldn't have a very good situation. I'm too young."
"But didn't he speak kindly, Tom?"
"Kindly? Pooh! What's the use of talking about that? I wouldn't care about his speaking kindly if I could get a situation. But it's such a nuisance and bother. I've been at school all this, while learning Latin and things, not a bit of good to me, and now my uncle says I must set about learning bookkeeping and calculation, and those things. He seems to make out I'm good for nothing." Tom's mouth twitched with a bitter expression as he looked at the fire. "Oh, what a pity we haven't got Dominie Sampson," said Maggie, who couldn't help mingling some gaiety with their sadness. "If he had taught me bookkeeping by double entry, and after the Italian method, as he did Lucy Bertram, I could teach you, Tom."
"You teach?"
"Yes, I dare say. That's always the tone you take," said Tom. "Dear Tom, I was only joking," said Maggie, putting her cheek against his coat sleeve. "But it's always the same, Maggie," said Tom, with the little frown he put on when he was about to be justifiably severe. "Why, you're always setting yourself up above me, and everyone else, and I've wanted to tell you about it several times. You ought not to have spoken as you did to my uncles and aunts. You should leave it to me to take care of my mother and you, and not put yourself forward. You think you know better than anyone, but you're almost always wrong. I can judge much better than you can." Poor Tom. He had just come from being lectured and made to feel his inferiority. The reaction of his strong, self-asserting nature must take place somehow, and here was a case in which he could justly show himself dominant. Maggie's cheek flushed and her lip quivered with conflicting resentment and affection, and a certain awe as well as admiration of Tom's firmer and more effective character. She did not answer immediately. Very angry words rose to her lips, but they were driven back again, and she said at last, "You often think I'm conceited, Tom, when I don't mean what I say at all in that way. I don't mean to put myself above you. I know you behaved better than I did yesterday. But you are always so harsh to me, Tom." With the last words, the resentment was rising again. "No, I'm not harsh," said Tom, with severe decision. I'm always kind to you, and so I shall be. I shall always take care of you. But you must mind what I say." Their mother came in now, and Maggie rushed away, that her burst of tears, which she felt must come, might not happen till she was safe upstairs. They were very bitter tears. Everybody in the world seemed so hard and unkind to Maggie. There was no indulgence, no fondness, such as she imagined when she fashioned the world afresh in her own thoughts. In books there were people who were always agreeable or tender, and delighted to do things that made one happy, and who did not show their kindness by finding fault.
The world outside the books was not a happy one, Maggie felt. It seemed to be a world where people behaved the best to those they did not pretend to love, and that did not belong to them. And if life had no love in it, what else was there for Maggie? Nothing but poverty and the companionship of her mother's narrow griefs, perhaps of her father's heart-cutting childish dependence. There is no hopelessness so sad as that of early youth, when the soul is made up of wants, and has no long memories, no superadded life in the life of others, though we who looked on think lightly of such premature despair, as if our vision of the future lightened the blind sufferer's present. Maggie, in her brown frock, with her eyes reddened and her heavy hair pushed back, looking from the bed, where her father lay to the dull walls of this sad chamber which was the center of her world, was a creature full of eager, passionate longings for all that was beautiful and glad, thirsty for all knowledge, with an ear straining after dreamy music that died away and would not come near to her, with a blind, unconscious yearning for something that would link together the wonderful impressions of this mysterious life, and give her soul a sense of home in it. No wonder, when there is this contrast between the outward and the inward, that painful collisions come of it. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.